listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
And greetings, my friends, patriots, lovers of democracy, truth, and justice, believers in peace, freedom, and the American way. Tom Hartman here with you. And breaking news, the three judges out of the District Court for the District of Columbia, the Appeals Court for the whatever, what do you call that thing? Circuit Court for the District of Columbia. Thank you, Shano. D.C. Circuit Court, which is one step below the Supreme Court. And, you know, part of the federal appeals court system, circuit court system, has ruled against Obamacare. They have ruled in a way that will destroy Obamacare if successful. I will lay out the details of that to you in a few minutes and also why I think that they will not be successful. And, you know, that this is just another Republican stunt, even though it's being done by guys in black robes. But meanwhile, the situation in Ukraine seems to be slowly, incrementally getting better. The situation, you cannot say the same for the situation in the Middle East, in Israel and Palestine. And Ray Hanania is with us. He's a Palestinian-American political columnist, managing editor of the ArabDailyNews.com. That's the ArabDailyNews.com. And Ray, welcome back. It's been a couple of years since you used to be kind of a regular on our show, and it's been a while.
Yeah, I was doing a radio show in Chicago for a while, and we would kind of simulcast you at the same time. So, yeah. But we listen to you all the time. My show has kind of drifted off.
Yeah, well, it's great to have you back on,
and
thank you for joining us. You wrote two pieces for the Arab Daily News that I and one was picked up by the Creator Syndicate or started there that I would encourage people to check out. One is more serious and sober. I mean, they're both serious and sober, but one is more upsetting, shall we say. Right. Media twists facts to make Israel look good in conflict with Palestinians, in which you document how long before these three Israeli kids were kidnapped and killed, on a virtually daily basis, Israelis have been killing Palestinians. And then the other one, which I think is perhaps not a larger issue, but a more, you know, an issue that Americans need to know also, is, you know, losing the PR war in Gaza, too. You take on the old cliche, Arabs have a great cause but lousy lawyers. Israeli have a lousy cause but great lawyers.
Right.
Let me just give you an opportunity to riff on these. From your point of view, what is happening in the Middle East right now?
Well, I mean, it comes down to this one fundamental fact, and part of it has to do with there's less sensitivity to the Palestinian side in the United States, more sensitivity to the Israeli side in the United States. The fact that Israel has been pounding the Palestinians regularly, there have been missile attacks from Israel into Gaza. There have been attacks from Israelis against Palestinians going on for months, but they got no attention in the U.S. media. Now, I could blame the media, which I do in part, but, you know, because they do have a fiduciary responsibility or professional responsibility to cover everything factually and fairly, and they don't always seem to do that. But I also blame the Arab community because we tend to stand up when we're angry. We tend to, you know, get involved when we're upset. And then when things are going our way or the rest of the world isn't beating up on us, we tend to be silent. So we didn't do a very good job between January and June 10th of pointing out the dozens of Palestinians that were kidnapped, that were killed by settlers, by Israeli soldiers, by missiles fired from Israel into Gaza. You would think that people in
this
Gaza.
This all before the so-called war began.
Yes, before the war and before the moment when we paid attention. And that was when three Israeli teenagers were kidnapped and apparently killed right after they were kidnapped. But we didn't know that, obviously, for 2 weeks. It wasn't announced until 2 weeks later.
Oh, Israel knew it after 4 days.
Yeah, I think the Israelis knew it. And I'm not sure whether they were manipulating it for their benefit or what. But
Let's give them the benefit of the doubt. Maybe they were conducting a police investigation.
Yeah.
Cops do that all the time.
Listen, first of all, it made me sick when three teenagers, because everybody says they're Israeli teenagers. I look at them just as kids.
Yeah.
Three kids kidnapped, killed, murdered. I mean, it's just disgusting. One of the so at that point, that's when the American public took notice. The Israeli PR machine, you got to give them a lot of credit, went into full gear, said, hey, this is the kind of stuff we deal with all the time. We need to respond to it, you know, and they waited. Obviously, they didn't do anything, hoping that if they believed the kids were still alive, that they might be released. And once it became known that they were killed, the next day, three Israelis went out, grabbed a Palestinian kid whose cousin is an American, and burned him to death. They kidnapped this kid. He was a teenager, 16 years old, burned him to death. And then the next day, the Israeli police went to his cousin's house. He's an American citizen, and I think he was in Ramallah or in that area, maybe in Gaza. I'm not exactly sure where. I think he was in Ramallah.
He was on MSNBC last night. I think he was in East Jerusalem.
Yeah, he might right in that area. Yeah. And they grabbed him. They beat him. The videotape, had it not been videotaped, nobody would have believed it. Yeah. You know, it was like that King beating that took place in L.A. a number of decades ago.
Yeah, the Israeli police were smashing him in the head with their boots.
He's a 16-year-old, and he's an American citizen. Now, here's one point where I thought the Israelis were very smart. You know, they're very emotional, but they're very smart. Hamas, when the three Israelis were kidnapped, really didn't do anything. They didn't really respond. They didn't take responsibility in the sense of not saying we did it, but we're going to find out who did this because these are three kids.
Had they
done that, it would have made us look good in the eyes of the American public.
But on the other hand, I mean, Hamas has a much larger problem than that. They continue to deny the existence, the legitimate existence of the country of Israel.
Yes,
and whether you agree with the 48 borders or all the others that have come along since then, the fact of the matter is Israel's not going to go away. And if they would simply acknowledge that, and as the Palestinian Authority has done, they could move from IRA pre-Maggie Thatcher to IRA post-Maggie Thatcher, to draw a kind of clumsy analogy.
They're not going to do that because they're part of the Muslim Brotherhood, the Hezbollah, the Iranian network. They're kind of all kind of tied in terms of being driven by religious faith.
Which means, doesn't it, that if the Gazans really want to have a future, that the first thing they need to do is vote out Hamas, and yet at the same time, this periodic lawn mowing, the periodic attacks into Gaza every 2 years by the Israelis, just harden the hearts of these people.
Well, I don't, just so you know, I agree with you. I agree that Hamas has been a fundamental weak spot in the Palestinian effort for statehood, that they've intentionally gone out of their way, not just recently, but since 1993, to destroy the peace process. Every time Rabin and Arafat would move forward with peace, they would explode a suicide bomber. And a lot of times these were young people. So every time they went towards suicide bombing and violence, it strengthened the far extreme right of the Israeli public into believing they're never going to have peace. Now, the Israelis reacted by becoming more extreme. And the fact is, the more extreme Israel becomes, the stronger Hamas becomes.
Right.
This war in Gaza is not weakening Hamas. It's strengthening Hamas.
Right.
It's
right wingers on both sides, actually. This is what Christoph pointed out in the New York Times.
Yes, the problem to me, and has always been, it's not really between Palestinians and Israelis. It's between moderates and extremists.
Yeah,
and I like to count myself in the moderate.
Yeah, and I know that, and I know it well, and I respect your perspective. Ray Hanania, website, The Arab Daily News, thearabdailynews.com. Ray, thanks for dropping by today.
No problem. I really appreciate that.
So it's always great to get your perspective.
All right.
And keep up the great work. We'll be right back.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
TheArabDailyNews.com. Ray Hanania. We'll be back. And welcome back. 15 minutes past the hour. And Mike listening to us in Lomita, California on KPFK. Hey, Mike, you wanted to follow up on something we picked up yesterday?
Yeah, actually, three short items. One, Henry clarification, the Tudor plan had to be Henry VII because he was the first Tudor monarch. The fifth was once more under the breach, dear friends, and all that sort of business.
Thank you.
Yeah, and...
And just for, so people know what we're talking about, I was basically saying that modern-day mercantilism, economic protectionism, national economic protectionism was started, I knew it was one of the Henrys, and it was called the Tudor Plan, and he was basically imitating the Dutch, who'd been doing it for 100 years before that. But this was back in the, what, 16th century, 15th century?
15th.
Yeah.
1485 is when he came in.
Right.
So the other point on Gail Trotter about how we should lower U.S. corporate tax rates to be competitive with the rest of the world,
yeah.
Well, this sounds like deja vu. 40 years ago, they were starting a plan. They didn't say up front they're going to lower our real earnings, but that's what's been happening with globalization over the past 40 years. And
yeah.
If they start lowering corporate tax rates, we're going to have another race to the bottom with corporate tax contributions worldwide, I think.
Yeah, and let me add to that, the thing to watch out for, Reagan was, I don't know if he was the first president to do this or just the first that I could find, but Reagan got this fast track thing passed through Congress where Congress could basically short circuit itself and exclusively trade deals, which in my opinion should be treaties and require two-thirds of the Senate, but nonetheless, according to the Constitution. But nonetheless, trade deals were labeled as legislation that could be passed with a simple majority vote that could not be debated on the floor, at least over, you know, beyond a very, very brief period of time, and that could not be amended in any way, straight up or down vote. And now we've renewed that fast track authority a couple of times over the years, and it's been expired a couple of times over the years, and it's expired right now. And the only way that Obama is going to get SHAFTA, the Southern Hemisphere Asian Free Trade Agreement, also known as the TPP, the only way he's going to get this thing through is to first get fast track authority rules set in Congress, which means that he's got to get a majority of the House and Senate to vote yes on fast track. And I think that that's going to happen in the dead of night on Christmas Eve or just before New Year's Day, you know, at the very end of this legislative session. And keep an eye out for it and keep the pressure on your legislators not to do that. Back to you, Mike. We got a minute.
Yeah, I just wanted to say, though, that on our friend from Santa Fe who was equating cash with speech, I think we have to reform the founding documents to fit the current law of the Supreme Court and say that all some men are created more equal than others, that they're endowed by their parents with
lots of money,
liberty to speak a thousand times louder than the common man, and through corporate avatars to determine what form of religion and contraception their employees may observe.
Yeah. So let's rewrite the Declaration of Independence.
I think so.
Yeah. Or the preamble to the Constitution, for that matter. I mean, you know, mm-hmm. It's both of them. Yeah. Mike, very, very, very good stuff. Very good stuff. Thanks a lot for the call.
And sure.
Thanks for listening. I found this website. It's over at topplebush.com. It goes back years. And it's titled Blame Everything on Ronald Reagan. It is such an amazing list. I'll share, you know, we're gonna start this, like, you know, year long project of sharing with you this list. But I want to get to this court decision. We'll do that right after the break. Tom Hartman here with you, and remarkable. Okay, here's what happened in the courts this morning. We had a conversation with Ian Millhiser on this program 3 weeks ago, I think, or so, thereabouts. And he said, you know, we were talking about Ted Cruz shutting down the government and Obamacare and lawsuits and all this stuff. And Ian is he's a lawyer, and he's the legal blogger, the head legal blogger over at thinkprogress.org. And a very smart guy whose opinion I respect. And Ian said there is one case going through the courts that could blow up Obamacare. Now, there were two attempts, actually. One is Ron Johnson in Wisconsin. And he was trying to blow up Obamacare with what his colleague, Jim Sensenbrenner, another Republican from the same state, said was a political stunt. And, you know, basically he was suing, saying, you know, we don't like Obamacare. And the federal judge in Green Bay said, sorry, you don't have standing. You cannot demonstrate that you've been harmed by Obamacare, and neither can your co-plaintiff, and so we're throwing this out. Okay, so that's the good news. The bad news is the Affordable Care Act says in fairly plain language that, let me get the exact quote, if I can find it. Basically what it says is that, you see, it assumed that every state was going to establish an exchange. And it says, I should have highlighted this. Anyhow, it says that the tax benefits, the subsidy basically that you get under Obamacare is a consequence of the state exchange, right? The state exchange determines your eligibility for the Obamacare subsidy. Now, elsewhere in the law, it talks about, you know, it says, for example, the Secretary of HHS, quote, shall establish and operate such exchanges within the state, and the Secretary shall take such actions as are necessary to implement such other requirements. In other words, there's kind of a fallback if a state doesn't do one. The title of the Affordable Care Act is actually called the Affordable Coverage Choices for All Americans, the subtitle, excuse me, of this provision. It doesn't say all Americans except those who live in states with federally run exchanges. And so, you know, this goes on. There's a bunch of reasons to think that this decision is bad. There were three judges on this case. And two of them, one was Judge Raymond Randolph, who was a Bush 1 appointee, and the other was Thomas Griffin, a Bush 2 appointee. Randolph is a demonstrable whack job. I mean, he's a total right-winger. Judge Harry Edwards is the third. He was a Democratic appointee. He cut off Harry Edwards in the middle of a sentence and started quoting from an editorial in Investor's Business Daily to justify there being no Obamacare. Judge Randolph has come right out and said that Obamacare is, quote, an unmitigated disaster. So, but anyway, what these guys who were funded in part by the American Enterprise, they got this guy who was earning $20,000 a year and living in West Virginia, and brought him into court. And this guy says, you know, I expect to only make $20,000 this year. The availability of credit, I'm reading from the decision here. The availability of credits on, his name is David Klemenik. He was given standing. He resides in West Virginia, a state that did not establish its own exchange, and he expects to earn approximately $20,000 this year. He avers, he says, that he does not wish to purchase health insurance and that, but for federal credits, he would be exempt from the individual mandate because the unsubsidized cost of coverage would exceed 8% of his income. The availability of credits on West Virginia's federal exchange therefore confronts Klemenik with a choice he'd rather avoid. Now, just think about this for a minute. I'm reading from the decision here. This guy who's making $20,000 a year does not want to have health insurance, even if it's essentially free. Here's the choice he'd rather avoid. Purchase health insurance at a subsidized cost of less than $21 a year or pay a somewhat greater tax penalty. He admits to being at least partly motivated by opposition to, quote, government handouts. This is where, you know, the rich Republicans find some schlub to front for them. And I guarantee you this guy will be well compensated one way or another. And then they ruled in his favor, and they should have stopped there. I mean, that's judges and courts, they rule on an individual case. But, oh, no, they didn't stop there. Instead, they say, having concluded, although our decision has major consequences, our role is quite limited, deciding whether the IRS rule is a permissible reading of the ACA. And it should be deciding whether this rule is permissible for the ACA with regard to this guy. But instead they say, having concluded that it is not, we reverse the district court and remand with instructions to grant summary judgment to appellants and vacate the IRS rule. In other words, no more subsidies for Obamacare in a state that only has a federal exchange.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
Now, if all that sounded wonky and confusing, I will boil it down to just a few simple sentences and tell you how this is a setup for the Civil War. Right after this break. So here's the, by the way, welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Just to break this down, here's what happened in the ruling that was handed down this morning by the U.S. Circuit Court for the District of Columbia here in D.C. by a three-judge panel. Now, this is now going to be appealed, and it's going to go to the entire court, which is, what, 11 judges? Thank you, Shane. And they, in that court, it's a 7-4 majority of Democrats to Republicans, as I recall. This was a 2-1 majority of Republicans to Democrats, appointees anyway. And that's exactly how it was decided. So this isn't just totally partisan. But even if the entire court knocks it down, it'll then go to the Supreme Court, where you've got a 5-4 majority of Republican appointees. And on the one hand, you know, they're very, very partisan. And on its face, if you read this, you know, the wording of the law, the way it was written by Congress, it would be very, very easy for the Supreme Court to simply say, much like they did with the Civil Rights Act, to simply say, you know, the language of this is not concise. The language, because the language says that you get your tax benefits through the state exchange. State exchange certifies you for that or determines your eligibility for that. And so, therefore, in those states that don't have exchanges, like Oregon, tried it and couldn't afford to, you know, I mean, they just screwed it up. So they said, ah, screw it. We'll go with the federal exchange. Tennessee, I believe it is, on the other hand, is it Tennessee or no, it's Kentucky. Kentucky, on the other hand, has a Democratic governor, even though they've got Republicans coming out their ears every other direction. They put in an exchange. Their people love it. So Shane and I hold slightly different opinions on this. Shano is saying that the Supreme Court will say, here's the language. The language specifically says it has to come through a state exchange. And so in those states without an exchange, you've got no Obamacare subsidies, thus no Obamacare. And I can understand the Supreme Court saying that. Makes perfect sense, and it's true. And they would, like they did with the civil rights case, they would simply say, Congress, do your damn job. You can fix this with a piece of legislation that changes one sentence. You could insert the words after the word state exchange. You could say state or federal exchange. That's all you have to do, right? Add two words, or federal. This could be done with a piece of legislation that is one page long. And it would only have to be passed by a simple majority in the House and Senate, signed into law by the president. The Affordable Care Act is amended. Everything is great. Because when it was written, when this part of the Affordable Care Act was written, there was an assumption that every state would have an exchange. I mean, why wouldn't they, right? At least that was the thinking of the people who wrote the law. Well, you know, writing laws, I mean, Medicaid, Medicare, both of them, Social Security, all of these things have been amended in some cases thousands of times over the years to make them more, you know, bring them up to date, to make them work more smoothly. But right now, because of the caucus room conspiracy, the Republicans are saying, we will not amend anything. We will not fix anything. Any part of the government that's not working, tough luck. We want it blamed on Obama. This is the blame Obama Congress. The blame Obama, do nothing and blame Obama Congress. Do nothing and make life miserable for people. Don't extend unemployment insurance. Make those people destroy their lives, 3 million people. They'll blame Obama. And the fact of the matter is, between 60 and 70% of American voters don't know who controls the House and Senate and how. But 95% of American voters know that President Obama, that President Obama is a Democrat and that he's president. So things aren't working. Hey, I'm losing my health insurance. Hey, I lost my job. Hey, my unemployment insurance just went away. Who do you blame? You blame the only guy that you're sure is actually there and supposed to be doing it. You blame the president. This is the Republican strategy. And so the Supreme Court could very easily say, and Shane, I think that there's a very good chance that you are right. I think it's less than a 50% chance, but I think you're right. Yeah, there's a very good chance that you're right. The Supreme Court could simply say anybody who lives in a state that doesn't have its own exchange no longer qualifies for Obamacare. And Congress can fix this by adding two words to the law, but it's up to Congress. And, of course, Congress won't fix it, at least not for the next 2 years. That could happen. I think, frankly, that Congress is, or that the Supreme Court is going to look at this and say, you know, it was clear from the way the law was written that the intent of the law was to cover everybody. It talks about, you know, achieving near universal coverage. It talks, you know, repeatedly throughout the law. So it would be stupid to pass a law that has its own time bomb built into it. This is simply an example of clumsy language by Congress, but it doesn't obscure their intent, and therefore we're going to pass on blowing up Obamacare. That's how I think the Supreme Court will rule, and I think largely because John Roberts, just like the first time he had an opportunity to destroy Obamacare and he passed on it, he doesn't want his legacy, the legacy of the Roberts Court, to be that he's the guy who destroyed one of the most popular programs in America. But let's say they do. Let's say Roberts actually does strike down Obamacare in those states that don't have federal exchanges or that don't have state exchanges. What happens? We now have a U.S. map of red states and blue states with and without. Right now it's with and without Medicaid expansion. Soon it could become with and without Medicaid expansion and with and without Obamacare subsidies. In other words, we could have a map of the United States in which the red states are operating like a bad third world country. I mean, at least Mexico has a national health care system. Guatemala has a national health care system. The Guatemalan refugees who are showing up on our border have a higher rate of vaccination than Texas kids, because one in five Texas kids lives in poverty, and Rick Perry won't extend Medicaid. So, they're unvaccinated. But the kids coming from Guatemala, they're all vaccinated. They got a national health care system. It's free. So either we are going to become, in the red states, they're going to start looking like a third world country that is less developed than Guatemala, whereas the blue states will begin looking more and more like European states, like fully modern, contemporary democratic republics. And the divide is going to get wider and wider. And what does that lead to? Secession? Civil war? Or simply a lot of human misery before people wake up to the fact that Republicans, acting at the behest of transnational corporations, but most importantly, eccentric, cranky, libertarian billionaires, have totally screwed them. And they've been doing it since the Reagan administration. That this is simply the logical extension of Reaganomics. So, anyhow, that's my take on it. Sean wants to disagree with me. Sean, thanks for calling from Shreveport, Louisiana. What's up?
That was the most incredible speech I've ever heard in my life, Tom. Let's blame the conservatives for everything. The progressives are really good at it.
Sean, let me ask you a question. I will stop blaming Republicans and conservatives if you can name one piece of significant legislation that the Republicans have proposed and passed in my lifetime, in the last 60 plus years, that principally benefited working class people rather than billionaires or corporations. If you can just name one piece of legislation.
Well, are you going to cut me off after I do it if you don't like my answer?
No.
Okay. Then the Bush tax cut.
The Bush tax cuts were principally for very wealthy people.
No, they were not.
Yes, they were.
The Bush tax cuts, no, they were not. The Bush tax cuts enabled people who were able to provide jobs, because nobody's ever worked for a poor man.
That's not true. A lot of people work for poor men. Most small businesses started in the United States are not started by rich people. They're started by poor people. I started two businesses, one with an unemployment check and the other with a Sean filibustering me is not going to make your argument any stronger. And the other with a line of credit from American Express. I was poor. I started businesses. That's the norm in America.
And if you can get a line of credit from American Express, you needed two things. You needed credit, and you needed
an American Express
money that they would put up against up against that to make sure they get paid.
No, my
lots and lots of money.
No, it's unsecured. Sean, your American Express line of credit is unsecured. But you wanted to tell me, we only have a minute here, Sean, and then I will have to cut you off because I get cut off by the machine. So why do you think that I was wrong in what I said?
Because, as usual, the Obamacare is a horribly, horribly written law. And as much as President Obama believes he can do whatever he wants, the Constitution says otherwise. And the only part of the government...
When did Obama assert that he could do whatever he wants?
He's rewritten 30 or 40 different parts of Obamacare by administration action.
George W. Bush did the exact same thing with Medicare Part D.
No, he did not.
The exact same thing.
He did not change laws.
He absolutely did. He issued all kinds of executive orders exempting specific groups and adding people.
He did not change laws.
He did. Yeah, I'm sorry, Sean. Go back and read your, you know, Google it, right? Or go to duckduckgo.com and plug in George Bush modifies Medicare Part D. It was the modifications were more extensive, they were more sweeping, and frankly more consequential than the modifications that Obama has made to Obamacare. It's you know, I'm sorry, you're just wrong. We will be back. It's 15 minutes before the hour.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And engaging in hyperbole makes the wrong even less credible. I don't think I'm engaging in hyperbole when I say you can't find a piece of legislation that Republicans passed that helped working people. So this guy, David Klimenik, he is expected to earn approximately $20,000 this year, according to this argument in court. Lives in West Virginia, a state that doesn't have a federal exchange, and he says, I don't want Obamacare. It costs me $21 a year, and I am opposed to it philosophically. I don't believe in government handouts. And therefore, I'm joining with these billionaires and these big corporations who are funding this anti-Obamacare campaign and saying, I don't want it, and stop it. And these two Republican appointee judges just agreed with him. Very strange. Keith, in Shorewood, Wisconsin, you have a theory about why David Klimenik, this guy from West Virginia who's going to make $20,000 this year, is going to the D.C. Circuit Court and saying, please take away my $21 a year health insurance?
Thanks for a nice lead-in, Tom. And also, I want to make a broad point after that. But when my Republican friends always tell me that I'm playing the race card, I tell them, don't deal it to me in the first place. I think we've seen this a lot with people in that situation. They have no rational reason why they should be avoiding this. But I think with a lot of these guys, they just simply think, I don't want to get any help from the black president, pure and simple. What do you think, Tom?
I think that might be part of it. I think also we know that, and you know, Lee Atwater laid this strategy out, you know, famously back in 1981 after he had successfully run the Reagan campaign, you know, he said we used to use the N-word and then we started talking about forced busing and nowadays we don't. You've got the clip? Oh, here's Lee Atwater in his own. He says nowadays all you have to do is talk about, you know, cutting off benefits and everybody gets it that, you know, or even taxes. Just talk about taxes. Everybody gets it that you're talking about whacking black people upside the head because we have made them synonymous with quote, welfare. Here's Lee Atwater in his own words.
You start out in 1954 by saying, by 1968, you can't say that, that hurts your backfire, so you say stuff like forced busing, states' rights, and all that stuff. And you get so abstract now, you're talking about cutting taxes, and all of these things you're talking about are totally economic things, and the byproduct of them is blacks get hurt worse than whites. And subconsciously, maybe that is part of it. I'm not saying that. But I'm saying that if it is getting that abstract and that coded, that we're doing away with the racial problem one way or the other. You follow me? Because obviously sitting around saying, we want to cut taxes, we want to cut this, and we want is much more abstract than even the busing thing. And a hell of a lot more abstract than, you know.
Yeah, the beeps, of course, being the N-word.
Yeah.
So, Keith, I think that it's both. I think it's any kind of government benefit is framed by libertarians and right-wingers as, look out, black people are going to get that. And even though there's more white people getting all forms of welfare in the United States than black people. And then secondly, yeah, you got a black man in the White House, and how dare he even try to have a legacy? Although, frankly, I think that if it had been Hillary Clinton, you would probably see something very similar. And, you know, you could attribute part of that to misogyny, but most of it simply to it's a Democrat.
And I think that, here's the thing, though. I think if they get this thing passed somehow, I really think this is going to be political suicide for the right wing, because there's a lot of people, like here in Wisconsin, I think we have 40,000 now are covered under the federal exchanges. That's going to be political suicide to yank that away from people.
I think so. One of my kids is on Obamacare and very, very happy with it. I think everybody has somebody in their family or a neighbor or somebody that they know. 40,000 people doesn't sound like a lot in a state like Wisconsin, but Wisconsin has what, 5-6 million? What's the population of the state?
Yeah, about a little over 5 million right
now. Yeah, so 40,000 people is, a little less than 1% of the population, which means that the odds are probably pretty good that at least half, maybe two-thirds of the population knows somebody or has somebody in their extended family, given that most people, have about 150 acquaintances and family members that they communicate with regularly. That's the average for the human race. Odds are people know somebody.
So, and we know 74% of those people are happy with it.
Yeah, including Republicans. Keith, thanks for the call. Excellent point. Steve in Phoenix. Hey, Steve, what's up?
Hey, good morning, Tom, or afternoon, or whatever it may be.
Yeah.
Just want to, thank you and Mike Papantonio so much for, he's brilliant. But anyways, our situation with the health insurance, you had mentioned a little bit ago that your premiums had rose 30% in the past year. Well, ours have done the same.
As small businesses.
She works for a large national company. I really don't want to mention who it is.
Yeah.
But, the deductibles have went also from $1,200 to $1,500 single deductible, but you got to meet a $3,000 family deductible before anything's met, before they pay. And then they pay out at an 80-20 rate.
Right.
And this is $3,000 every year. And I'll tell you, you wrote your book, The Crash of 2016. Well, it's a brilliant book. I've read it. I've got it as, from the free speech premiums.
Cool.
And
thank you.
I'll tell you, it's great. And it will happen sooner or later, because with policies like this, no one's going to have any money to go out to eat. They're not going to have money to go on vacation. They're not even going to be able to go to the doctor, and you can't enjoy any of life's simple pleasures. And, we got to get a single-payer plan like Bernie advocates, and it's...
I'm astounded. I was on the air when this happened. I think it was 2005 or 2006. Toyota was going to cite a plan. I'm pretty sure it was Toyota. It might have been Honda. I sometimes mix up the Japanese companies, but I'm pretty sure it was Toyota. They were going to cite a plant in the United States, and you had three or four states that were competing about who could give them the biggest subsidies. They were offering them tens, hundreds of millions of dollars, free land, 10-year tax abatement, blah, 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 blah. And in the end, Toyota ended up moving that plant to, as I recall, Windsor, Canada, right across the river from Detroit, or in that neighborhood, in the Toronto neighborhood. And when they were asked why, they said, because Canada has a national health care system and America does not. And when we added up the cost of not having to pay for the health care of our employees, over the next 20 years for our factory versus the tax cuts and goodies that America was offering us, it was a better deal doing business in Canada. This should be a Chamber of Commerce argument. This Obamacare as a first start, and then Vermont single payer as the next step. But this should be the argument that business people are making. Steve, thanks for the call. I think you're absolutely right. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com, America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com, Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com, providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartmann.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartmann Program.
And welcome back. Tom Hartmann here with you. And, see, I get the same thing here. Click send. Oh, now it's working. All right. Every now and then, you know, when you live in a country or a city or a building that only has one internet provider or a small number of internet providers, and they all tend to have crappy service because that's just the nature of monopolies, strange things happen. So, anyway, welcome to the home of strange things. And where is my call screening software? Here it is. So, okay, this is our second hour. There was a couple of other things I wanted to get into today. I think that, you know, I've pretty much made my point on the two Republican judges who ordered Obamacare to be defunded, and you know how. Shane may well be right. I mean, this might be the thing that sets us up, arguably, for the next civil war. I mean, or something like that. Meanwhile, the youth leader of a far-right British political party threatened his dog on Facebook over the animal's homosexual behavior. Jack Andrew Renshaw, the leader of the BNP Youth, says, "I wish my dog would stop licking the penises of other male dogs. I love you, but don't, Derek, my dog, but don't challenge my principles because my principles will likely win." Right. Okay, Snowpiercer. We talked about that yesterday, didn't we? This is amazing. Pot is now a $25 jaywalking ticket here in Washington, D.C. It's the lowest penalty of any state in the union. I realize D.C. is not a state, but, you know, it sort of claims that status. And meanwhile, Patrick Devlin writing over at Fire Dog Lake, actually it was cross-posted there from M. Law, writes, "Scientists in England are reporting what could be a significant breakthrough in the treatment of all forms of cancer, stating that their research suggests that cannabis's psychoactive ingredient, known as tetrahydrocannabinol, could act to shrink cancerous tumors in patients stricken with the deadly disease." You'll remember, is it Tommy Chong has prostate cancer and he's treating himself with hemp oil? It made a lot of news a year or so ago. I have no idea how he's doing or even if he's still around. But the researchers were at the University of East Anglia, the place where they famously hacked the emails about global warming, where the researchers were disagreeing with each other about minutia. You know, no, it's 1.6 degrees. No, it's 1.3 degrees. How can you say that? It's 1.6. The data's obvious. No, you're just being a jerk. It's 1.3 degrees. And you know, the global warming deniers and the Flat Earth Society tried to pretend that that meant that there was some kind of a debate about global warming. There wasn't. There was, there's debates among scientists. But anyhow, this is a famous university, and they do really good work. And they say the THC, the stuff in pot that gets you high, appears to affect two receptors found in cancer tumors. These are called cannabinoid receptors. And when these receptors are activated, it shrinks the growth of the tumors. It slows the rate at which cancer grows. In fact, reverses it. The scientists bombarded human cancer cells in mice with doses of THC that were isolated into compounds for the research study. The compounds were found by the researchers to help shrink tumors. The scientists hope that their discovery can lead to the development of a synthetic form. See, that way you can make money on it. A synthetic form of the compound, which can be patented and sold for $1 million a shot or something, that can eventually provide relief for patients who've been diagnosed with cancer. Why not just give them a joint? The nation's medical researchers from the National Institutes of Health, this is our nation, the United States, he notes the UK researchers' discovery supports the opinion of the U.S. medical establishment. Although U.S. medical researchers are by and large stuck with this embargo, quote, the United States nation's medical researchers in the National Institutes of Health reported in July of 2012, this was 2 years ago now, quote, this is from the National Institutes of Health, NIH, which, by the way, holds a patent on medical marijuana. Or actually, the DHS holds the patent. NHS is, I think, part of DHS. They say, quote, evidence accumulated during the last decade supports that cannabinoids, the active components of cannabis sativa and their derivatives, possess anti-cancer activity. End of quote. That's our National Institutes of Health. That is not Colombia's or Ecuador's or Castro's. It's ours. So they caution that this cannabinol was diminished tumors was specially synthesized for the experiments. It was targeted directly at the cancer cells in specific concentrations, a medical application that cannot be achieved by cancer patients by self-administering cannabis using common methods of cannabis ingestion. Scientists from Canada, New Zealand, the United Kingdom, and the United States have found that heavy users of cannabis, people smoking pot for years, have no greater chance of contracting lung cancer than casual cannabis users or non-cannabis users. Most notably, they don't have the risk of developing lung cancer that cigarette smokers do, yet they're both inhaling burned plant matter. Why could it be that here the annals of American Thoracic Society last year, the habitual use of marijuana alone does not appear to lead to significant abnormalities in lung function. Overall, the risks of pulmonary complications, heart disease, pulmonary is the lung disease. Complications of regular use of marijuana appear to be relatively small and far lower than those of tobacco smoking, end of quote. The journal actually went farther in another article from 2013 saying, quote, cannabis smoking does not seem to increase risk of chronic obstructive pulmonary disease or airway cancers. In fact, there is even a suggestion that low doses of cannabis may be protective for both conditions. However, they are quick to note, no studies have been performed in the United States in recent years on human subjects due to the embargo against researching the medical benefits. And this is in large part because the woman who runs the Drug Enforcement Agency, the DEA, does not know the difference between pot and heroin if her testimony before Congress is to be believed, which I don't believe. I don't think Michelle Leonhardt is that dumb. An interesting piece here from a veteran. Actually, this is going to take more than a minute. I just have a minute till the break. Here's one. This over at Democratic Underground also. Sarah Jaffe, they reposted it. It was originally at BillMoyers.com. It was reposted by Scuba. The bad boss tax. Basically, what these state legislators in Minnesota are proposing is that, or at least Take Action Minnesota, a progressive activist group there, is that employers that use this business model of pay your employees just low enough that they qualify for food stamps and housing assistance, don't pay them enough that they lose their ability to qualify for those things. Therefore, the business model is basically, our business is subsidized. This is the Walmart business model. This is the fast food business model. That those employers have to pay back to the state the money that their employees took in benefits. It's called the bad boss tax. So let's basically end that business model. makes great sense. This is absolutely brilliant. Absolutely brilliant. Okay, I want to talk about PTSD, suicide, bilaterality. And we will do so right after the break. And then we'll pick up your calls as the day goes on.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
We'll be right back with more here on the Tom Hartman Program. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you and Anita in San Antonio, Texas. Hey, Anita, thanks for watching Free Speech TV. What's up?
Yeah, hi, Tom. Earlier you stated you didn't think Justice Roberts would rule against the Affordable Care Act this time because he cares about his legacy.
Yeah, the odds I'm giving of that are roughly 55-45.
Well, see, I don't think he cares at all about his legacy.
Pardon?
I don't think he cares at all about his legacy. I think his rulings have basically all been pretty much pro-corporate. Yeah. Even if you look at his ruling, his earlier ruling on the Obamacare,
mm-hmm.
he allowed Obamacare because that's pro-corporate, but he didn't allow for the forced expansion of Medicaid within the states.
Which is just pro-poor person. Yeah,
right.
Right.
It's just pro-corporate.
Right.
So I don't really think he cares at all about his legacy. I mean, why would he rule the what he did in Hobby Lobby or Citizens United or anything like that?
Well, it's
I'm really worried about this.
It's a good point. There was a lot of blogging after the Affordable Care Act decision, suggesting that by people who were apparently clerks in the court, who knew the players. Suggesting that that Scalia and Thomas were furious with Roberts for not striking down Obamacare when he had an opportunity to, and that they were saying, Scalia and Thomas were saying, that the reason why Roberts, in their mind, wimped out was because he didn't want to go down in history as, sort of like Roger Taney, the judge who decided Dred Scott, the Chief Justice, he didn't want to go down in history as the guy who killed off who established a major judicial precedent in the face of Congress feeling a very different way. And when Taney ruled in favor of ruled against Dred Scott, ruled in favor of Sanford, his owner, Taney was arguably at that point in time defying the majority public opinion in the United States. He was certainly defying Congress, which allowed the northern states to say slavery is illegal.
But I think Roberts looks at the long game more.
Yeah.
I mean, which is why he will dismantle things piece by piece.
You may well be right.
And Scalia are pure ideologues, But yeah. Roberts looks at the long game. He's been wanting to dismantle the Voting Rights Act since Reagan.
Right.
Since he worked for the Reagan administration. He's always looking at the long game.
Yeah. And he was down in Florida teaching, just before the Supreme Court ruling argument in 2001 in Bush v. Gore. He was down in Florida teaching their lawyers how to argue before Rehnquist because he used to be Rehnquist's clerk. I mean, this guy was made for this job from a Republican point of view. And that didn't come out until long after his confirmation. And, in fact, to this day, he still has not confirmed it, but other people who were down there with him have confirmed it. And, in fact, it's been covered in several books over the years. But, the more I think about it, the more I think you're right. He's basically doing what Lewis Powell did, get him on the court in 72 and then, waits a couple of years. And in 76, the Buckley case comes along and says, hey, let's give free speech rights to people who just want to spend money. And, let's create doctrine. I think, Anita, you may well be. Thank you for the call. I hope you're wrong. Let me say, you may well be right. You and Shane. You may well be right. We'll be back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. There's a vet posting over at Democratic Underground how he was in Iraq 10 years ago, 2004. And this last month, June, had so many terrible holidays or anniversaries or whatever in it, as well as other events. He says, it just pushed me too far. and he tried to commit suicide. He slashed up his wrists. There was blood all over the place. He ran out in the front yard, passed out. His wife called 911, and they took him to the hospital. And then he checked himself into the psych ward of the Veterans Administration for a month. And he just got out, and he's telling his story about basically this is what the war did to me. And he's got a wife and young kids, and he says, I feel mostly good and mostly optimistic right now. Sorry for what I did to my wife, kids, and parents. Don't feel any guilt or remorse toward myself. Numb is the best way to describe my feelings right now. As before, images, thoughts, and regrets about the war permeate my head nearly nonstop. I have to take care of this stuff before it kills me. Now, I can't speak to this particular vet. I'm not licensed anywhere right now. I used to be on the roster of psychotherapists with the state of Vermont, which gave me legal authority to hang out a shingle and call myself a psychotherapist and practice psychotherapy in Vermont. But I only did that for 2 years. And I had a consulting practice. This was back before I was doing radio. I had a consulting practice that was almost entirely on the telephone, and my clients were almost entirely psychiatrists and psychologists. And mostly what I was doing was I was teaching them NLP and working through really problematic cases that they had and providing them with different frames and different ways to approach these particular problematic cases. And I write about some of that in a book I wrote called Walking Your Blues Away, which, and I don't want to turn this into a pitch for my own book because there's a lot of good resources for this. But I want to tell you about this. There are ways to resolve those horrible memories and put them in the past where they belong and drain them of color and turn them black and white and turn the sound off and just to put them behind you. There are ways to do that, and they are fairly straightforward, and they fall into two broad categories. One that I've never written about, but I know about. And now we're starting to get some good research on that, and that's the use of psychedelic drugs. I don't encourage anybody to do that without somebody with them who really knows what they're doing in an appropriate context. The other, which doesn't involve any drugs at all, is called bilateral therapy. And bilateral therapy began in a big way in the modern era, back in the late 1700s. In the 1780s and 1790s, there was a guy by the name of Franz Anton Mesmer. He was an Austrian, as in the country next to Germany, not the one near New Zealand. And he was a psychiatrist. He wasn't a psychiatrist. That was back in the days when you could basically declare yourself anything. And Mesmer came up with this theory that what healed us was the power of the moon. And so he developed a system where he would place a person on basically a fainting couch, a love chair, kind of, you know, where they could recline slightly, but they were still inclined so that their face was available to his hand. And he would put his left hand up in the air toward the moon and his right hand in front of their face and wave it from side to side. And while he was doing this, he would have them discuss with him their illness. Now, he very quickly learned this did not treat things like gonorrhea. Right? This was not useful for organic bacterial infections, viral infections, wounds. But it was spectacular for what was referred to back in that day as hysteria, which would include all forms of post-traumatic stress disorder, people who are traumatized by abuse, whether it was childhood abuse or adult abuse, spousal abuse or boss abuse or cultural abuse. He was just having spectacular results, both with psychological illnesses and with people who were having physiological expressions of psychological illnesses. So this became big. Ben Franklin went over to Paris to see a demonstration of Mesmer doing this. Mesmer was basically licensing people to do mesmerism all over Europe, and Franklin wanted to bring it back to the Americas. He sat with the French Academy of Sciences, which he had recently been admitted to, and they watched a demonstration of mesmerism. They tried it out on each other. They concluded that maybe there's something to this, but we think he's hyping. And Franklin kind of left it at that. But it was a big deal. That was in the 1780s, 1790s. By the 1830s, I think it was 1834, there was a psychiatrist in Scotland by the name of James Braid who said, this moon stuff is nonsense. Yes, it works. Mesmerism works. Everybody agrees it works. Because what they were doing was basically integrating the left and right hemisphere of the brain. If you move your eyes across the midpoint, back to back, side to side, while thinking of something, it will cause changes in the emotions associated with that thinking. Everybody got that. Everybody got that. So Braid said, this has got to be because the eyes are getting tired or some other internal physiological process. And I will prove that this has nothing to do with the moon by dangling a pocket watch in front of somebody, which is not connected to my body. It's connected to a chain and not putting my left hand up where the moon is. And I'll produce the same results as Mesmer. And he did. And Braid named this first neurohypnotism in 1834. And then by 1837, 1840, something like that, he called it hypnosis. Freud practiced hypnosis in the 1880s. In fact, his seminal book, Studies in Hysteria, written with Joseph Breuer, his mentor, was all about the case of Anna O, this woman that they used hypnosis on for both diagnosis and therapy. And Freud repeatedly talked about how he used this hypnosis. This was the most powerful technique ever. And then suddenly, in 1897, Freud had to abandon hypnosis. And bilateral therapies vanished from the face of the earth until about 20 years ago. And I'll tell you how and why after the break. It's an amazing story.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
And although I wrote about this in my book, Walking Your Blues Away, I don't know of any other source for the story I'm about to tell you. It's just, you're going to find it incredible. We'll be right back. Slightly unbalanced and showing you, teaching you, telling you, giving you a handle you can grab hold of about how to get more balanced. Okay, just to recap, we've got vets all across this country who are suffering from PTSD, and it's not just vets. Nobody gets out of childhood, you know, unscathed. Most people have wounds from their past that haunt them. This is the normal human condition. And so when I put this book together, Walking Your Blues Away, this was years ago. I wrote this book more than a decade ago. My original question was, if our bodies are self-healing organisms, you cut yourself, it forms a scab, eventually the scab falls off, there's a little scar tissue, eventually the scar tissue even vanishes, unless it's huge. If our bodies are self-healing organisms, why aren't our minds? And I thought, they have to be. Our minds have to be self-healing organisms. And we know that, the mind will go to a lot of, it'll induce amnesias, and there are ways that the mind can heal itself that are sometimes even maladaptive. A lot of people who are acting out in really negative ways are doing so in an attempt to accomplish a positive outcome. It's one of the predicating principles of NLP. So I was thinking, if Zog and Og, back 100,000 years ago, go out wearing their saber-toothed tiger skins, hunting the great woolly mammoth, and the woolly mammoth turns around and gores Og, and he's dead, and Zog has to bury his friend and then go back to the community, the tribe, and say, sorry, Og is dead, and watch Og's family go through all that grief. And how does he deal with that? How historically have humans dealt with trauma, psychological trauma, emotional trauma? And it occurred to me that, he's going to have to walk a few miles to get home. Could it be that in the process of walking, moving left to right, activating the left side of the body, then the right side of the body, the left side of the body, the right side of the body, our brains are bilateral, right side of the brain controls the left side of the body, left side of the brain controls the right side of the body. Could it be that the simple act of walking home while thinking about the trauma he experienced could heal him psychologically? And the reason why is because of this bilaterality, which I was in the middle of telling you the story about. And let me just finish the story very quickly. So you had Mesmer in the 1770s coming up with mesmerism. In the 1830s, James Braid, Scottish psychiatrist, says, no, this is nonsense. It's got nothing to do with the moon. It has to do with people's eyes going back and forth and back and forth, and I can prove it with a pocket watch. By the 1880s, it was so widely used, mesmerism, or what was renamed now by James Braid as hypnosis, was used as surgical anesthesia. It was used as dental anesthesia. Ether was just becoming popular. It was used as a therapeutic technique both for psychology, and this was the height of psychiatry, by the way. This was, you know, this is when Freud was coming of age. This is when Carl Jung was coming of age. I mean, this was the golden age of psychiatry. And everybody was using hypnosis. And then all of a sudden in 1897 or 1898, and I'm doing this from memory, and it's been a decade since I wrote the book, but I'm pretty good with dates, so I'm pretty sure I got it right. In one of those 2 years, everybody stopped using hypnosis. Why? I could not find the answer to that question anywhere. And having been trained in neurolinguistic programming by Richard Bandler and licensed and certified by the Society of NLP, and part of that training was hypnosis, you know, I know the power of this stuff, the therapeutic power of this stuff. I was like, you know, why did it vanish from the face of the earth from 1898 until the 1950s? When Milton, I'm forgetting his last name, the famous psychiatrist, brought it back into public acclaim. Why did it vanish? Why did Sigmund Freud not only stop using hypnosis, but start using cocaine in 1897? And he did that for 7 years until he finally had, you know, cocaine psychosis, and his best friend committed suicide on cocaine. And then he said, okay, can't do that. He wrote a book of love poems to cocaine, which is still in print. But then after 7 years, he decided, this is dangerous stuff. And so then he came up with the Oedipus complex. It's all about, you know, men being in love with mom. And then the Electra complex. No, it's all about women being in love with dad. And then he came up with talk therapy. Oh, maybe if we just talk about problems enough, we can solve them. And what he discovered, and that's where his life, you know, he eventually committed suicide in the 1920s, as I recall, maybe the 1930s. He committed suicide because he was in such pain. He had throat cancer from smoking pipes all these years. But when Freud committed suicide, he was a bitter, bitter, grouchy old guy. And most of his patients were getting bitter and grouchy. This is the most common outcome from Freudian psychotherapy, from talk therapy, is that people become like Freud. So why did he quit hypnosis? And so I ran around for like a year, more than a year. I knew a lot of people. I'd been writing in the field of ADHD and neurological differences for a half a decade, since my first published piece was in 1980 in the Journal of Orthomolecular Psychiatry on the hyperkinesis syndrome. And then I did work with Ben Feingold before he died in 81 or 82. I forget what year he died. So I knew a bunch of people, and I asked everybody I knew, why did Freud stop using hypnosis in 1897? Nobody knew. So I went back and I started looking at newspapers from the 1890s. And what I found was that in the 1896, there were newspapers all over the world that were talking about three very celebrated cases of stage hypnotists who had been convicted of doing nasty things to either audience members or to their generally attractive younger female assistants under hypnosis. Typically not on stage. They would do it later or under other circumstances. They'd hypnotize people in the audience and say, meet me tonight at midnight, that kind of thing. And it was usually about sex. Well, that was kind of scandalous. But then I discovered that in 1897, the number one selling book in the world, the third largest best-selling book for the entire 19th century, being only surpassed by Harriet Beecher Stowe's Uncle Tom's Cabin in the 1850s and by Alexis de Tocqueville's Democracy in America in 1834, this was the third best-selling book of the century. It was translated into dozens of languages. It was it was a novel. It was called Trilby. And every upper-class woman in Europe and North America read this book. This was the book. This was John Grisham and Susan, what's her name, Susan Collins, and Tom Wolfe. Roll them all together. Add in Ernest Hemingway. I mean, this book sold what in today's numbers would be hundreds of millions of copies, given the population then it was loveless. And the story, so I got a copy of Trilby, still in print. It was published in French by Georges de Millier, and it was translated into English. I forget the name of the American translator, but the English translator, but, you know, the English version is out. And I read it. And Trilby is the story of these three or maybe four starving artists living in Paris. And one of them is a guy who knows hypnosis. And he's Jewish. And the book describes him in very anti-Semitic language as having the Jewish nose and Jewish features and all this kind of stuff, right? It's very anti-Semitic. And this sweet young 15-year-old named Trilby comes and is a nude model for these four guys. And the bad guy, the Jewish bad guy, hypnotizes her. And over the course of the rest of the book, he teaches her how to sing, and he does this world tour with her where he hypnotizes her during the day. At night, she goes up on stage. She sings like nobody ever sang so beautifully before while she's hypnotized. Afterwards, he takes her back to the hotel, has his way with her. And then she wakes up the next morning out of the trance going, "I'm sore, my throat hurts, and what's going on?" And then the next night he hypnotizes her again and it repeats. And eventually she figures out that she's being hypnotized. She breaks the spell. And when she breaks the spell, they both die. Trilby and this bad Jewish guy whose name was Svengali. This is where Svengali came from. Well, a lot of the people who were, particularly in Europe, who were practicing psychiatry and psychotherapy and using hypnosis were Jewish. And there was a lot of anti-Semitism in the world in the late part of the 19th century. Not that there isn't today. And virtually all of Sigmund Freud's patients had read Trilby. So, and in the book Trilby, it describes how Svengali had Trilby lay down on the couch. He put his hand in front of her, waved it back in front of her eyes, which is exactly what Freud was doing. So you can imagine, all, you know, his patients just one after another screaming and jumping off the chair and running or off the couch and running out of his office. You couldn't use hypnosis anymore. Trilby destroyed it for generations. But it actually does work, and it actually is therapeutic to have your eyes go from side to side. The Francine Shapiro in the modern era has trademarked this and has made quite a business out of it, and a good one. The U.S. Army has tried it out. It's called EMDR. And in NLP, there's other techniques that are associated with it. There's a whole bunch of schools of this stuff. And what I found is that you can walk with this. You walk intentionally bilaterally, swinging your arms. You can't be holding anything in your hands. And while you're walking, you bring up those haunting thoughts. And eventually they diminish. Now, this is not medical advice to you. You can find this in the book, Walking Your Blues Away. But the bottom line is there are treatments for this stuff.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
And in many parts of the country, the Veterans Administration offers EMDR therapy. And if you're a vet in crisis, I recommend you get it. And welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. And we'll be getting to Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service as soon as our commercial stations rejoin us. Right now, Janet in Mount Vernon, Washington, watching Free Speech TV on cable TV there. You want to talk about the ACA ruling?
Oh, yes. When I heard that this morning, I really wanted to weep. It's like, dear God, they think like it's going to hurt the president. No, this hurts, you know, millions of people.
Right.
But the
other shoe has dropped, Janet. You don't know this. I should have mentioned this at the top of the hour, or at the bottom of the hour, but I wanted to finish that thought. The Fourth Circuit Court just ruled an hour after the D.C. Circuit Court, and these are basically pure courts. They both have the same power. They're both one step below the Supreme Court. The Fourth Circuit Court ruled, the ruling came out at 9:40 this morning, saying that the Affordable Care Act is not struck down, and that if you live in a state that uses a federal exchange, you can still get your discount. So it's definitely going to go to the Supreme Court now. Back to
you. Well, again, this is not that does not give me much comfort right there, because who knows what Roberts will do.
Well, here's the thing. But, of the 9 million people who are getting Affordable Care Act under the Affordable Care Act, who are getting, you know, Obamacare, 5.5 million of them are getting subsidies, and where is that money going? It's going to for-profit health insurance companies. Roberts is a corporatist. He goes where the profits are. And so I think that, you know, while he's perfectly happy to strike down Medicaid because that's a single-payer system and nobody's making money on it, I don't think that he's going to cut, you know, 5.5 million people's revenue stream directly channeled into United Healthcare. He's not going to blow that up, I don't think.
No, and that's why you hear the businesses are very, very quiet about, you know, objecting to the Affordable Care Act because it benefits them, you know, down the road. But also, Tom, many years ago when I first graduated from college, my first job was working for General Motors, and I worked there for many years. And I have to tell you, I was salaried, but whenever a union contract was, whenever they signed a deal, this was like every 4 years for the national contract, they would bring all of the salaried people in, and they would tell us what was going to happen to our benefits because they would always sweeten it up because they did not want the salaried, you know, workforce to become unionized as well.
Right.
And back then, I can tell you, if GM and Ford and Chrysler were honestly, if they were honest, and you made a good point about that Toyota plant going to Canada, they all supported single payer. They wanted to get out from under the burden of this health care. It adds to a huge amount to the cost of a vehicle.
Yep. $2,000 a car in the United States.
Pardon me?
It's $2,000 a car in the United States.
Well, they need to decouple it, period, from employment. And, you know, that would mean single payer. And that is the, you know, that's the, and I would love to know who the money was behind this guy in West Virginia. Was it, you know, the Heritage Foundation?
Competitive Enterprise Institute, which another one of these right-wing groups that's funded by right-wing billionaires.
Exactly. You know, the smell of the money. And the other thing, and this is just a quick point, I don't know, because I know you don't probably watch TV, but maybe some of your listeners do. All of a sudden, these Coke Industries ads are springing up everywhere.
Yeah,
CNN,
I do watch an hour or so of TV a day. I get home and I check out MSNBC and Fox. And yes, I'm seeing them. We are Coke Industries. We are wonderful. Really? Really? Janet, thanks for the call. Excellent observation. We'll be back. Welcome back. 10 minutes before the hour, Tom Hartman here with you, and we are in a building that the Heritage Foundation owns, and our air conditioning just died, and it's getting really, really hot in here. And so we're going to bring Bob Ney on with the Talk Radio News Service, and Jim, can you turn the lights off in here for me? Because these lights are hot. And Bob Ney with the Talk Radio News Service, talkradionews.com, on the line with us, the author of Sideswiped. Hey, Congressman.
Hi, Tom. How are you?
I am well. So what's going on in the world today?
Well, on the decisions, of course, one court taketh and the other court giveth. And I heard you talking about that. And then the administration can ask for what's, you know, called the en blanc vote, which would be an 11-member active D.C. Circuit Court of Appeals, which is a 7-4 court. If you look at the Democratic
7-4 Democratic appointees to Republican appointees.
Republican members. And so,
do you see where the Fourth Circuit just ruled the opposite way from the D.C. Circuit?
Yes. You have the Virginia court has now ruled opposite of the U.S. District Court of Columbia. And that court, I'm sure it's Virginia, if I remember, the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals.
Yeah, it is.
And then, now, it's not the exact ruling, but it's a similar case that upheld the subsidies. So you have the Fourth Circuit Court of Appeals, Virginia, upholding the subsidies in a very similar case.
Right.
And then, of course, you have the case you're talking about, the 2-1 vote.
Yeah, the Fourth Circuit was, I don't know if they were citing Chevron or not, but the Supreme Court has ruled in the past that when the language of a law arguably conflicts with the stated purpose of the law, that rather than going with the language, we should go with the purpose. And that was the rationale, I understand, of the Fourth Circuit's ruling, whereas the rationale of the D.C. Circuit's ruling was the language of the law, you know, may clearly be an error, but this is the language of the law and we're sticking with it.
And so now it can be asked by the administration for what's called the en blanc ruling, where the entire 11-member D.C. Circuit Court would vote. And then, of course, it could go to the U.S. Supreme Court. It was interesting to see Senator Hatch's comment about the White House, you know, not following the intent of the law. But, you know, even if this, let's say this hypothetically would go to the Supreme Court and be struck, you know, down, there's too many people in these exchanges, too many states involved, 36 some states would be at risk here that would still probably have to insure people, although the subsidies would obviously break everyone. So, you know, it'd be fascinating to watch what the Republicans would what would they do? Would they just let the people just sit there? You know, and
well, that's what they're doing with, you know, 3 million long-term unemployed. Mm-hmm. It's what they're doing with people who qualify for Medicaid in the red states where they're not allowing them to take the Medicaid money. So, of course, the Republicans would just sit there and let people die.
It would be absolute, I think, chaos. So it would be interesting to watch, you know, what happens through the rest of the process here.
Yeah. And what happens to somebody who just got insurance under the Affordable Care Act, and it's costing them, like this guy in West Virginia who brought the case before the D.C. Circuit Court, $21 a year, and they went into the doctor and they just got diagnosed because they hadn't seen a doctor in years and they didn't know what that lump was, and they just got diagnosed with cancer or some other god-awful condition, and they're just starting treatment, and now the courts are going to say, oh, no, sorry, if you want to keep getting your treatment, you're going to have to come up with $1,000 a month for somebody who's not even earning $1,000 a month after taxes.
Mm-hmm. Oh, it could be, you know, just a complete nightmare.
Yeah.
Obviously. One thing that they have agreed on, they did agree on a $10 billion money appropriation into the Highway Trust Fund.
Mm-hmm.
Now, that only holds it probably to about March, although Senator Boxer wants to do an amendment which would make the Congress go a little bit quicker, maybe towards the end of 2014, in order to try to address this situation, because no state can move on with any of their design, engineering, or planning. And so that shows, you know, how desperate this fund actually is right now for it to even get the House to go along with it.
Yeah. But my conspiracy theory here, Bob, and feel free to knock this down if you think I'm wrong, is that the Republicans in both the House and the Senate, they don't want, if funding gets through, and it actually hits the people on the ground before November, their lives are going to get better. And if people's lives get better, they give credit to the president. If people's lives suck, they blame the president.
Well,
and
they waited this long, and if you look historically at this fund, Bush tried to sabotage it through Andy Card. His chief of staff tried, and that's because Andy Card had this historical thought that George, you know, that Bush 41 lost his election and that the highway funds didn't help him, some kind of convoluted thought. But the Congress still pushed on at that point in time and went around Bush and the Republicans and passed this. Now they have let this fund sit, and nobody's really feeling the total repercussion yet. You're correct. You know, they're not feeling the whole wrath, but yet if they would have, you know, pumped money into this earlier, there would have been projects advanced.
Right. You'd have hundreds of thousands of people who'd have jobs.
Right. Now this advances the planning, design, and engineering only.
Yeah. So, anyway, what else is up, Bob?
Well, and the other thing is that, you know, you still have, we have the situation at the border. You've got Governor Perry, who's now, you know, renounced his cowboy boots and is changing his style. And he's further sending 1,000 of the National Guard to the border. He is requesting, Tom, that the federal government pay for it. Now, he knows quite well, I don't think that the Fed will pay for it, but he'll appropriate $12 million out of somewhere. It'll be interesting to see how long he will keep the guards at the border, but he is going to issue 1,000 of the Texas National Guard.
So we've got children who are fleeing armed militia, men in uniforms who with guns have killed their parents and their siblings, and Rick Perry and those children are coming across the border looking for police officers to turn themselves into and Border Patrol agents to say, you know, please, I'm afraid of the army guys, the death squads. You know, the gangs, I'm afraid of the guys with the big guns. You know, please give me refuge. And Rick Perry's solution to this is to send big guys with guns in military uniforms to, what, point their guns at these children?
Well, you know, Rick Perry knows that this sells well in Texas, but also I think Tommy's looking towards the national stage, which never
Oh, of course.
Happened.
He announced this in Iowa.
But yes, in his mind, I don't think it'll happen. I don't even think the Republicans would be foolish enough to do that. Well, maybe I'm wrong, but I don't think so.
Time will tell.
Wrong before.
Never underestimate, frankly, either political party, Bob.
That's
Bob Ney, author of Sideswiped and member with the Talk Radio News Service. Thank you, Bob.
Thank you.
Brought to you, by the way, by goatsfortheoldgoat.com and free-don.org. We'll be back.
You're listening to Tom Hartman.
Hey, friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com, total protection. Quicken Loans, engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com, your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program.
Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you. Let me wander off onto another topic altogether from the ones that we have been covering, although you're welcome to call about any of the things that we've talked about today in a little bit when we get to the phone call part of the show, as it were. But I wanted to share with you two stories that I thought went together really, really well that... And by the way, those of you watching us on TV, you may have noticed I have changed into a Goats for the Old Goat t-shirt. And the lights are off in the studio. The reason why is because our air conditioning died. It's over 80 degrees in here. And I am partly concerned about cooking me. I'm frankly far more concerned about cooking our electrical equipment and losing the ability to even communicate with you. And so we turned off the lights. So our TV signal... Our radio signal should sound just fine, but our TV signal is a little darker than normal. But, you know, what can I say? Hopefully we will get there was a power burp earlier. And power, you know, if you've ever in your life, and most people have, turned an air conditioner off and back on really quickly, it causes them to freeze up and freak out and seize up, and they just don't know what to do. The more modern ones, you know, they just kind of automatically shut themselves down for a while, then come back up. But I think the one for our entire building doesn't know how to do that. This building was built probably 100 years ago, and or a little less actually, because they're going to tear it down. But and you can't tear down a building in D.C. if it's more than 100 years old. But the AC system has croaked. Okay, the stories I was going to tell you about. In Portland, Oregon, there is this group called Child Evangelism Fellowships Good News Club. And what this group does is they go around, you know, people used to think that they had to worry about their kids being the victims of pedophiles in the public parks. Now it's this church group. They go around, when they see kids in public, particularly if the kids are not, you know, holding onto mom's hand, they go up to the kid and they start preaching the gospel at them. Five-year-olds, six-year-olds, seven-year-olds. You know, their target age actually is between 4 and 14, according to them. Moises Estevez, who is the group's vice president, said, "Children are easy to manipulate. We all know that. Therefore," he says, "we don't have to use schemes and high-pressure tactics. Nothing could be farther from the truth. I mean, children are easy to manipulate. We don't have to trick them into anything." This fundamentalist group is associated with creationist Ken Ham, who claims that this is part of a spiritual battle that goes back to the Garden of Eden. Travis Getty's writing about it over at rawstory.com. And a group of parents concerned about this have launched their own campaign to warn people in Portland about, you know, your kid going alone to the park or anywhere, any kind of public place, because this Child Evangelism Fellowship's Good News Club is going to get your kids. Estevas says, we do teach that children are sinners, but we're not nasty about it. The children are singing, this is in a Portland park where two volunteers led about a dozen children through revival verses and Christian songs. And they had the kids singing, my heart was dark with sin until the Savior came in. One parent who described herself, Travis Geddes writes, as a Christian, said a few hours with the group turned her away from their message. Mia Marceau of Vancouver, Washington, which is the town just over the Columbia River from Portland, Oregon, said volunteers told her 8-year-old son and his friends that they were headed to hell and therefore must convert their friends to Christianity, oh, and raise money for the Children's Evangelical Fellowship, the CEF. She said, my son was raised as a free thinker. He didn't buy it. He's having arguments with his friends over salvation. This is bizarre. Okay, so I present this as evidence one, okay, or as kind of category one of information. Let me give you category two. By coincidence, and I'm guessing it literally is a coincidence, Raw Story similarly, only this was last Friday, published a piece by Scott Kaufman titled, Children Exposed to Religion Have Difficulty Distinguishing Fact from Fiction, According to Researchers. They're quoting from a study that was published this month in the July issue of Cognitive Science. Cognitive, you know, cognition, thinking. So it's really the science of thinking, right? This is a peer-reviewed scientific journal that found that children who are not exposed to religion in their early years can more easily figure out when they're told fairy tales whether the characters are fictitious or not. Whereas children who are exposed to religion when they're young, who are told basically what in many cases, any kind of practical modern person would consider a fairy tale. You know, Moses parted the Red Sea. Jesus healed the sick by just, actually in the case of the centurion or the rich guy or whoever it was, just saying, hey, your faith did it. Those are the small ones, right? God strikes down people, frogs come out of the sky, all these kind of things. Children who are told these things at an early age, and you know, a snake talks to a woman and talked her into doing dirty stuff, and God got really PO'd about it. Children who are told these stories when they're young, throughout the rest of their lives, have a harder time distinguishing between fantasy and fiction, fantasy and fact. Which I would assert would make them more vulnerable to conservative pitches. Right? The Ayn Rand libertarian pitch is if only everybody in the world had access to perfect information and we had perfect marketplaces with no government intervention whatsoever, then the world would become a paradise. It's a fantasy. Atlas Shrugged, Ayn Rand's novel that has kicked off much of this movement that Paul Ryan requires his staff people to read. Atlas Shrugged is a novel. Dagby and her brother, who inherited their money from and their railroad from Daddy, sort of like the Koch brothers inherited their oil business and their money from Daddy. Dagby and her brother are fictional characters. It's a novel. And yet you've got Paul Ryan citing Ayn Rand as the sort and her story, her fictional characters and their behavior. John Galt was a fictional character. You've got Ayn Rand citing fictional, or you got Paul Ryan, who very obviously was raised with religion, citing fictional characters as the source of his economic theory. What's wrong with this picture? I was raised religious, I suppose. My mother was originally the Church of England, Anglican, Presbyterian. In fact, I think that was the church she and Dad were married in. But basically, she raised us in the Methodist Church, the United Methodist Church, which was, you know, a benign. I mean, it wasn't, you know, the crazy stuff, although I went through the crazy stuff for a year or two, you know, of showing up at the North Lansing Church of God and you know, being slain in the spirit and all that kind of stuff. I've seen it all. Spiritual deli. Right? But I'm wondering, is this, you know, this group, are they engaging in child abuse? Going out and telling children that they are sinners. And how does that relate to the fundamental conservative story about humans? I'll tell you that after the break.
This is the Tom Hartman Program.
And that story, by the way, goes back to 1634 and Thomas Hobbes, or the publication of Leviathan. Well, actually, it goes back all the way to the Bible. Welcome back. Tom Hartman here with you, and Mitchell in Paris, Illinois. Hey, Mitchell, what's up?
Hey, well, I just wanted to point out, with the rise of multinational companies, the world has become a microeconomic place, with the labor curve and supply curve intersecting the lower wages. And if there's a lot of multinational companies, we should have multinational unions.
And we should have multinational taxes.
Yes, but if I could travel the world, I would try to organize people into unions, like, you know, the automakers.
The USW, the United Steelworkers.
Workers in China and everything.
Yeah, Leo Girard with the United Steelworkers is doing that. And, what's his name, the head of the AFL-CIO? He wrote a nice blurb for one of my books. Anyway.
Yeah, if we want to fight national.
Yeah, James Hoff is the UAW. Anyhow, they're doing this now.
Organization.
Yeah, Richard Trumka. They're starting to do this. They're forming alliances with unions in other countries, and they're going into countries where there are not unions and pitching them. Although in some countries that, you know, gets you, like Nicaragua, Honduras, and El Salvador right now, that will get the death squads on your back. But yeah, I think you're right. And that's a really, really important point to make, is that we now have this multinational economy. We should have multinational unions, and we should have multinational tax laws, basically, rather than tax havens. Thanks a lot for the call. John in Albuquerque, New Mexico, watching Free Speech TV on Dish Network. What's up?
Yes, I have an interesting thing about the welfare situation where the reps always fall under that same very critical issue that they don't know anything about. I mean, a former friend of mine who comes from Midwest moved to Albuquerque because he couldn't stand all the blacks in his neighborhood. He was brought up in basically a lot of blacks in his late neighborhood. However, his last name and my last name are the same, only because I was adopted into the name. And he comes here, and then after a couple of years, he starts complaining about, oh, he wasn't treated fairly when he went to apply for a job. The Hispanic
This is a white guy?
Yeah.
Yeah, and he's complaining about being discriminated against by black people in the Midwest and now Hispanics in New Mexico, right?
Yeah, and I ended up with a question. I said, you know what? You should move to Wyoming and Montana.
Yeah, there you go.
That's where you will get, quote, your same equal, you know, treatment.
Yeah, well, this is what concerns me so tremendously, is that with the Affordable Care Act, I mean, if they knock down the subsidies, we're going to end up with half of America having good health insurance and half of America having, you know, arguably, you know, good government services, the blue states, and reasonably high taxes on rich people. And the other half of America having low taxes on rich people, very rich, rich people, and a lot of really poor, poor people. And that, you know, we saw that movie before in the 1850s, and it didn't turn out well. John, thanks for the call, and thanks for the story. It's a fascinating one. We'll be right back. It's 20 minutes past the hour. For We the People, it's the Tom Hartman program. Okay, the main pitch that this group, the Child Evangelism Fellowship's Good News Club, the main pitch that they're using is that because Eve listened to the snake and ate the apple, partook of the knowledge of good and evil, because she did that, God cursed her and said that you will bear children in pain and they will be tainted with your sin. And so we are all born sinners in need of salvation, in need of the curse that God put on us being lifted. The curse that God put on us because this woman engaged in this free will behavior. So this is their pitch. You are evil. And therefore, you need us to teach you how to sing these songs and to help you connect with Jesus. Who's going to save you? This is their pitch. This is not that different from the modern conservative worldview, and it's quite radically different from the modern liberal worldview. And here's why and how. And frankly, I don't have a problem calling myself a Christian and saying I'm a liberal. This is not about religion is bad or good, or conservatives or liberals are necessarily more or less religious. Although what you will find is that conservatives tend to be more religious, liberals tend to be more spiritual, in quotes, and less likely to be associated with an organized religion. And I think this is why. There's basically two ways to view the human race. One is that we're all evil, or most of us are evil, and occasionally there's a good person who comes along. Maybe a good person by virtue of biology. That was Hitler's sales pitch. Maybe a good person by virtue of survival of the fittest. That was the king's sales pitch in Europe. Hey, you know, we killed everybody else. We're the warlords, and we're setting up this kingdom, and go along with us, or we'll chop your head off. Or, as John Calvin proposed, that God picked them out, the good people among us. And if God picked them out, how do we know that God picked them out? Because God doesn't talk to us all. Well, the way you know is because they're rich. If they're rich, God picked them out. And this was the core tenet of Calvinism back in the day. But the net of this is there's only a small number of us who are good, who should be ruling us, who should be making decisions for our nation and for all of our futures. And if you're a Calvinist, the Koch brothers would be the best qualified to be running the nation. And it looks like they are. And if you're a Kingist, the defense contractors should be, and John McCain, anybody who can go, I'm the big tough guy, I want to have war, they should be running the country. And anybody in the military, we should salute them 16 times. And if you are, you know, the opinion that it is just, you know, well, that would be the survival of the fittest, picked by God. Yeah, what was the third one? That's three. Anyway, so this was the conservative worldview. And Hobbes put this forward, Thomas Hobbes put this forward in this book called Leviathan, saying that in ancient times, before we had the iron fist of church or state, there was no art, there was no letters, there was no meaningful form of locomotion, of movement, of transportation. And life was nasty, brutish, and short. Now, that was in 1634. 40 years later, John Locke came along with the Second Treatise on Government, 1674, and said, no, actually, we are all good. There are some among us who are evil, but most of us are good, and therefore we can govern ourselves. And he proposed in the Second Treatise on Government that we should all have access to life, liberty, and property, private property. And back in those days, the king owned everything. The king even owned your underwear. Well, that was pretty revolutionary. And, you know, a couple decades later, Jean-Jacques Rousseau was writing about the noble savage, because all these reports were coming back about African tribes and American Indian tribes who were living life with great happiness. They were just fine, thank you very much. They did not want the Western way of life imposed upon them. And they only worked 2 or 3 hours a day. They were the original leisure society. And Rousseau is going, hey, maybe people are in their natural state, happy, rather than unhappy, as Hobbes had proposed back in 1634. And this became the schism between conservative thought, the Hobbesian thought, that we have to have the iron fist of church or state. You have to have authority figures telling you what to do because we're all essentially evil, and the authority figures are the few good ones among us. Versus the Enlightenment that Locke and Hobbes and Jefferson kicked off, that said, no, we're all so all good that we can even trust the majority of the unwashed masses. Now, John Adams didn't agree with this. He referred to average people as the rabble. And there were many among the founders who thought that only property owners should be able to vote. But Jefferson prevailed and said, no, the people en masse, the people themselves, the masses, what John Adams refers to as the rabble, they are the ones who should be making the decisions. And so you can see where this theology that is being promoted by the Child Evangelism Fellowship Good News Club, that they are indoctrinating five-year-olds with, if the five-year-olds believe this, absorb this, and say, okay, this is how the world is. I was born evil. Everybody's born evil. Our only salvation is through Jesus. And once we've finished that, then we can join the family and we can run for Congress. And you get these right-wing evangelical hypocrites like David Vitter in the United States Senate. And I see this as like something that is somewhat alarming, frankly. And I'm impressed that this parents group has taken out a full-page newspaper ad warning parents in Portland, look out, they're coming for your kids. It's not just the pedophiles you have to worry about anymore. We'll be back.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Call 866-987-THOM.
So, your thoughts on anything from PTSD to the D.C. versus the Fourth Circuit to religion? Talk media for the rest of us. Welcome back to the place where smart people get their news, the Tom Hartman Program. And so anyhow, I've had my say, and Shane says the headline is going to be, I'm not even going to repeat that. No. Anyway, let's see what you have to say here. It is, after all, anything goes summer. Paul in Woodinville, Washington. Hey, Paul, what's on your mind?
Hey, Tom, I'll tell you, in terms of this Halbig case, this is Halbig versus Sibelius. This is the caption of the case. Sounds like hell, but just it's H-A-L, but you can think hell. Big hell, how big, you know.
Uh-huh.
I'm almost rubbing my hands with glee in this one, and I'll tell you why. I think this goes good deal both ways for us.
Mm-hmm.
And here's why. Well, here's what the court could say. They could say, well, no, the states have in a sense accepted the terms, because all the states, some of the states that didn't set up exchanges did accept the Medicaid money.
Right.
So that's, in a sense, accepting the terms of the law.
In the case of Oregon, I don't know if there's other states. There are states that set up the exchange. It didn't work out, and so they defaulted back to the federal.
Right. And then the other thing is, even the states that didn't set up an exchange, well, your citizens did enroll on the federal exchange, so that was good enough for you at the time. You didn't say your citizens could not. So you could go under that theory. So, but then they could say, okay, let's go the other way and say, no, they say, no, the words are the words, and they're going to take a hard line. And so the remedy is, like you suggested, well, Congress, they could get Congress to change the wording of the law. Ha ha, fat chance on this Congress. But the other remedy is this, and this is the one I really like. Well, just have your state set up an exchange. Then the rubber really meets the road, because Obama will be gone in 2 years, and then there's these citizens in these states who still need health care, and they're going to have to take it up with their Republican representatives in that state.
Right.
Now, that's a fight I'd like to see.
Well, here's the problem. The only problem with all of that, Paul, and this is the calculus that the Republicans have already done, is that the Medicaid expansion only reaches people making basically less than $15,000 a year, you know, in most states less than $12,000 a year. And so basically the working poor. And the Obamacare subsidies reach people making less than $50,000 or $60,000 a year. In a big way, they reach people making under $40,000 a year. Again,
right.
the bottom half of the greater, you know, the bottom 50% rather than the top 50%. And that bottom 50% is more than twice as likely not to vote as are people in the top 50%. And so the Republican calculus is, you know, and of that bottom 50%, you know, A, they're twice as likely not to vote, and B, the ones who do vote are more easily influenced by wedge issues like guns, gays, God, you know, immigrants, you name it, and racism. So they figure, you know, we will lose a few people. A few people are going to figure out that we've screwed them. But most people, we're going to be able to agitate them or else discourage them from voting.
Well, this is okay. I accept that, but at some point there have to be issues that get people to want to vote. And when you see that the state next door to yours, or a state, or your relatives in the state in another state have the health care and you don't, maybe you start to think about what about voting. And that's something that, I mean, that's an issue that you can't help people who won't help themselves. That's part of the. I have to say about that. We have to vote. As Democrats, we have to vote. So one other thing I wanted to point out, Tom, I wanted to give you this book when you were in Seattle, but I did not get to see it. This guy who calls from Louisiana, who says ACA is the worst bill ever written. He doesn't know how the bill was written. The book that I'm referring to is called Reinventing the American Healthcare System. It's by Ezekiel Emanuel, brother of Rahm Emanuel. It is
who is an MD?
Yes, it's the best book on the subject. This bill was written over the last 100 years. They didn't just write, and it's not a 27 or 4,300-page bill. It's a little over 1,000 pages, but it was basically strung together by about a dozen healthcare proposals that you've mentioned over the last 100 years, starting in 1912. And there have been about a dozen.
Yeah.
And so they took pieces of all of these, and so a lot of these were proposed by Republicans. They didn't just write all of this just in the last 2 years.
Probably the biggest parallel is not so much to Romney Care as it is to Nixon Care in 72.
A lot of it is.
What Nixon proposed and Teddy Kennedy shot down, basically, because he made the good the enemy of the perfect, or vice versa.
Yeah, and yeah, so this stuff has all been proposed. Most of it's proposed. And honestly, the ACA changes very little. When you read the book, you really can't change anything about the American healthcare system without totally messing it up.
Yeah.
Because it's so complicated. And this really doesn't change very much at all.
Right. Other than giving, starting in 2016, giving states an opportunity to experiment, which Vermont has already stepped up to the plate on that. Montana's talking about it. So I think the next 5-10 years are going to be very, very interesting. Wait, you earlier, Paul, said something's got to happen that's going to get people to vote. I think, frankly, it's going to be a Great Depression. I don't know. You look back at the history of this country, and you know the Great Depression of 1856 led right to the Civil War. The Great Depression of 1929 to 1932 led to the election of FDR. The Depression of 1770 led to the American Revolution. You know, things were so bad that the British passed the Stamp Act in 1773 to try and raise revenue because, you know, things were just crashing left and right. It's only during times of wild, extreme economic distress that you see anything from the Bolshevik Revolution to the American Revolution.
Revolution.
Pardon?
Yeah. Either of the French revolutions.
Exactly.
Frankly,
you know, FDR's revolution, which didn't involve guns and overthrowing a country, but it was every bit as much of a revolution as was Lincoln's and Jefferson and Washington's.
The European Revolution of 1848. I mean, that was what swept throughout Europe.
Yes.
That was another one.
And that got us stirred up here. Yes.
Yeah.
Yes. And they all at their base have not just economic disasters, not just people being thrown into poverty, because there are countries all over the world where people are born into poverty, live in poverty, they die in poverty, and they're not revolting. It's where people see their standard of life and more importantly, their children's standard of life starting to rapidly decline, whereas their expectations are at least stability and probably an improvement. And that's the J-curve theory. At some point, that curve splits apart wide enough that people revolt. And I think that you've got, I think the millennials are frankly, this is one of the reasons why I think there was so much Republican messaging at millennials about there won't be Social Security for you when you grow up, all this kind of stuff, was to say, diminish your expectations so that you don't revolt. Because when people revolt when their expectations are not met, not when they're hurt, but when their expectations are not met, it has to do with expectations versus reality, not with reality versus reality. So anyway,
that's right.
Anyway, Paul, thank you for the call. Brilliant analysis. Mark in Chicago. Hey, Mark, what's up?
Hi.
Can you take me off speakerphone, Mark?
I think I'm off now.
Okay.
Okay. I think it's important to. I think it's important to frame government programs not as handouts. I think that they are either the collective will of the people trying to set up a system that benefits everybody, because after all, it is everybody's tax money and democratically accepted reform or democratically accepted system is legitimate. People are the people, the spoiled losers in the process who didn't get the process to go their way.
It's either that or it's a hand up.
Right. Or I you have to frame it as government making up for the undercompensation of employers.
Right. Here's some bootstraps.
Workers. Right. So because Walmart being the most stark example, what business doesn't pay in wages, then they pay in taxes. And what's happening now is that business is refusing to do either pay wages or taxes. So you have the pauperization of the working people and the destruction of the middle class.
Right.
But really it has to be framed as either, making up for the undercompensation of workers, employers abdicating their responsibility, or it has to be, just the collective will of the people in the democratic process. And losers in that process, have to go along with it, even though they're, they can gripe about it, but they still have to go along with it. You know what I mean? Because the process prevails. So.
Yeah. Excellent points, Mark. Excellent points. And a good starting point for reframing. Thanks for the call. Stone in Nolanville, Texas. Hey, Stone, we got just a minute to the break. You got a quick one?
Yes, sir. First off, it's a little bit hotter in Texas than it is in your office. But
I imagine it is.
I have a question about your opinion on the fracking ban proposed in Denton, Texas.
Yeah.
What do you think? What's your opinion?
I think communities. I believe in home rule. I think if a local community wants to say we don't want fracking here, they should have the right to do that. I believe in democracy.
Even if it comes down to mineral rights and big oil pushing their sway around.
Well, it's I do. I mean, you can change the value of land overnight simply by zoning. You know, somebody may be sitting on a piece of land that's worth $1 million if you can put an office building or a casino on it, but it's only worth $100,000 if it's farmland. And local communities can say, we're going to zone this as farmland. Similarly, they can say, Chevron has the mineral rights to your property, but that doesn't mean we're going to let them extract the minerals. We're going to change the zoning. We're going to ban the fracking or mining or drilling outright. The local communities should have that right. And if you want to get more information on that, go over to the CELDEF, the Citizens Environmental Legal Defense Fund, CELDF.org.
You're listening to the Tom Hartman Program. Visit TomHartman.com for audio and video archives.
That's CELDEF, CELDF.org. Thomas Lindsay is the guy who runs it, and he's doing amazing work with communities all over the country. Welcome back. Morris in Long Beach, California, listening on KPFK. Hey, Morris, what's up?
Professor, I had the luxury of listening to Ralph Nader this past weekend, and I would strongly advise anyone within the sound of my voice to do the same. The topic was Gaza. And I also wanted to say that Nelson Mandela was considered a terrorist by our government until 2008. Yet when he died, he was the most renowned public figure in the world.
Yeah.
And every dignitary in the world attended his funeral services, except for one. And who do you think that was?
Remind me.
Netanyahu, because Mr. Mandela fought against apartheid, and of course Netanyahu promotes it. And I also wanted to leave with you with this comment. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, but so is violence. And thank you for taking my comment.
Sure. I missed what you said after the Morris. You said beauty is in the eye of the beholder, and then you said something else, and I missed it. What was it?
Yes. Beauty is in the eyes of the beholder, but so is violence.
Oh, but so is violence. Yeah, or at least so is the culpability for violence. I mean, this is the debate that's going on both in the Middle East and in Ukraine. Yeah, excellent points. Excellent points, Morris. Go ahead.
Please listen to Ralph, because I've listened to Ralph a lot, but I thought he was going to start crying. Not because of the demonization of the Palestinians, but because of the MSM reporting on it. Unbelievable.
Yeah.
I was listening to Meet the Press, I think it was Meet the Press, on Channel 4 MSNBC, and it was my favorite senator, Mr. Lindsey, was there, and of course Mr. Kerry, who reminds me of Ronald Reagan with a good hairstyle, and they were not being informative voices. They were being divisive voices. They weren't voices of peace. Jesus, I mean, I think the best thing in terms of world peace, keep us out of it. I hate to say that, but you keep us out of it.
Yeah.
And you got a shot.
Yeah, I'm with you, Morris. I'm with you. And Ralph Nader, I can't say he's a personal friend, but Ralph and I have met and talked a lot of times, both on and off the air, and I have so much respect for him. And he's Lebanese, I believe, his parents or maybe his grandparents were from that part of the world. So, as I recall, I shouldn't represent Ralph. I'm not 100% certain. Morris, thank you for the call. Thank you, Paul, watching Free Speech TV in Morganton, North Carolina. Hey, Paul, what's up?
Hey, how you doing, Tom?
Good.
I'm a conservationist and an environmentalist and a journalist down here in Western North Carolina who has worked over the past 20 years for land protection and fought for the protection of our waters, led one of the largest conservation efforts ever in the history of the Eastern United States for land protection.
Mm-hmm.
And I would want to notify everybody that's listening that North Carolina, Appalachian Range is in dire threat as of a vote that took place in the House on the fracking bill. It passed by one vote, and the lady, the representative, accidentally hit the wrong button and immediately wanted to rescind her vote, which they wouldn't allow it. She sued to get it removed. They wouldn't allow it, so they got the bill passed.
This is the North Carolina legislature?
Called. And now there is a study going on to frack, a geographical study, to determine where they can put the holes to frack the upper ridge of the Blue Ridge above Asheville, Cherokee, all the mountains.
So the waste will go downstream, or maybe in the groundwater it'll go downstream. And oh, that's terrible. Paul, thanks for the heads up on that. I'm sorry we're out of time, but thank you for the heads up on that. I'm going to have to dig into that deeper. I appreciate it. We'll be back. Welcome back. Tom Harbin here with you and Corky in Hilton, New York. Hey, Corky, what's on your mind?
Yeah, hello, Tom. I was listening to your rant about the PTSD.
Right.
I was wondering, in your training, have you done a study on the effects of PTSD versus a strong moral conviction? Can one cause the other? I mean, like, I read that Sergeant York, who had to go home to square the circle about killing people, which his moral conviction said killing somebody under any circumstance is wrong.
Right.
He had to go home to square that circle before he could go back to war.
Right.
And I'm wondering, as somebody who goes to war,
I would submit to you, Corky, that probably the vast majority of people, or a significant number of people who are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder as a consequence of war.
You still there?
Can you hear me? Can you hear me, Corky?
Okay. Hello.
Corky can't hear me, so that's not good. Corky, I'm going to drop your call, and you can catch it on your TV or radio. But I would submit to you that the vast majority of people who are experiencing post-traumatic stress disorder are doing so as a consequence of in war of having to have violated core principles. You know, the core principle, thou shalt not kill. And then they say, oh, but you can kill them. And then somebody goes off and kills somebody, and they see the person that they've killed, and they start feeling remorse, and then that. But the essential nature of post-traumatic stress disorder, the thing that causes it to be PTSD and not something else, not just guilt or shame or bad feelings or whatever, the thing that causes it to be PTSD is that it's a giant emotion that every day when you wake up feels like it happened that day, typically associated with an experience. And the reason, the best theory about what makes PTSD PTSD is that we have a one-day scratch pad in the brain. It's called the hypothalamus. And it basically just kind of keeps track of what happens all throughout the day. It's a one-day scratch pad. It's a 24-hour memory. And when we go to sleep, the hypothalamus starts dumping the data from the day into the rest of the cortex, into the rest of the thinking brain, and it sorts it and to figure out where to put it in the brain. And it sorts it based on an emotional criteria, because this is something all mammals do, even nonverbal mammals. And this is things that nonverbal humans do. So it sorts it based on emotion, and it stores it in actual physical locations around the brain based on an emotional code. And that's why our dreams are heavily emotional, but not necessarily logical, because dreaming is that sorting process. Keep this, throw that away. Keep this, understand it this way. Well, what happens is when you've got this giant wampum, oh, my God, I killed somebody, from the day's experience, you go to sleep that night, and that gets out of the thalamus, the hypothalamus, and hits the brain, and the brain goes, whoa, can't handle that, that's too big, and pushes it back. And so when the person wakes up the next morning, it's still there. And this is a 24-hour scratch pad. Everything that you, all your hypothalamic memory is, feels as if it's today's memory. So the challenge in treating post-traumatic stress disorder is, how do you move that memory out of the one-day scratch pad, the brainstem? How do you move it out of there and into the conscious brain, where it can be thought about, processed, understood, made sense of, and eventually set into the part of the brain that says, this is the past. This no longer has consequence. It's a lesson learned, but it's no longer driving my life this moment. How do you do that? And the bilateral therapies are incredibly successful at doing that, because what it allows to happen, whether it's walking or whether it's the eye-to-eye motion, EMDR and hypnosis, regardless of which kind of bilateral therapy, where you move from side to side, side to side, side to side, because they're very effective, because it allows the hypothalamus to dump into the entire brain. It makes the entire brain available. It frees up lots more resources, whereas normally everything goes out of the hypothalamus into the left hemisphere, and then from the left hemisphere into the right hemisphere, where we try to make sense out of it. And, or actually, I've got that backwards, but whatever, you get the point. And it's got to follow this kind of circuitous route. Being bilateral at the time you're experiencing it makes the entire brain available to process this stuff, which is why people have much better results with that. So, anyway, Richard in Calumet, Michigan. Hey, Richard, what's on your mind?
I called to just let you know they do have a synthetic form of THC called Marinol.
Yeah, you're right.
And if you have immune problems, such as AIDS or other immune compromising diseases, you cannot take Marinol. Your body will reject it and can have really, really serious consequences, even death.
Yeah, and this is the problem with trying to make a synthetic form of any natural substance, is first of all, most natural substances don't exist in a vacuum. They exist synergistically with a whole variety of others. And so, you know, when somebody smokes pot or makes pot tea or pot brownies, they're getting literally thousands of different chemicals that are designed to interact with each other. It's one of the things I loved about Chinese medicine when I studied it when I was in Beijing back in the late 80s. The herbal part of Chinese medicine, there's always at least four herbs, and they're whole herbs. You know, you don't typically use extracts. You take, you know, so you're getting thousands of compounds that balance each other and do this very delicate dance with each other. And I think, frankly, you know, we're going to see in Washington State and Colorado, we're already seeing. You're seeing families actually moving to Colorado because the pot there is curing their children of seizure disorders.
Right.
great. That's the Charlotte's Web strain.
Yeah.
It's very low in THC, but extremely high in CBDs and CBNs.
Right, the cannabidols, and
yeah.
And as opposed to the cannabinol. And it's, I think that, you know, we're kind of like doing the research that the National Institutes of Health should have been doing for the last 60 years or longer. We're doing it now as civilians on the ground, and it's a marvelous thing to behold. Richard, thanks a lot for the call. So that wraps it up for today. We covered a lot of territory. I hope it was interesting and useful to you, and that you will share it with others. And don't forget, democracy is not a spectator sport. If we're going to make this country work, maybe we can pull this off without a crash, right? Maybe we can get enough people active. Maybe you can help sign people up to vote. Get people involved. Get people engaged. Help them dismiss their cynicism. Tag, you're it. See you tomorrow.
You've been listening to Tom Hartman. For audio and video archives, go to TomHartman.com.
Hey friends, Tom Hartman here. Thanks so much for watching and listening to the program. The Tom Hartman program is brought to you in part by the following underwriters. Identity Guard. Count on us to help protect what makes you, you. WIX.com. Everyone deserves to have their own website. ITMTrading.com. America's source for rare coins and precious metals. BostonBeer.com. Boston Beer, maker of handcrafted beers. Geico.com. Providers of insurance. IdentityGuard.com. Total protection. Quicken Loans. Engineered to amaze. And EcoWine.com. Your source for organic wine since 1980. These underwriters support our show, so please help by supporting the people who make this program possible. You can learn more at TomHartman.com.